The following Stealing the Mind of America presentation by Marlon Maddox is entitled, Should You Trust the Major Media? For a complete audio and video teaching tape catalog, call Compass at 1-800-977-2177.
There was a cover story that I took note of back Time Magazine, January the 23rd, 1995. It was written by a guy by the name of Robert Wright. I'd never seen him before, and thankfully I've never seen him since. And I saw Mr. Wright on one of the TV shows. He was very young, very intellectual, very arrogant, the personification of the elitist mentality. And in his article in Time Magazine, here are some of the things that he wrote. Here's what he said. He says, talk radio is only the beginning. Electronic populism threatens to short-circuit representative democracy. He even laments by saying, letting C-SPAN's cameras, the electorate's virtual eyeballs, peer into more congressional hearings, and all House documents are being put on the Internet for mass perusal by modem. Well, horrors, ladies and gentlemen. People might actually find out what the boys in Washington, D.C. are cooking up for us without the national media deciding what we should know and what we shouldn't know. As I've often said and informed, the most dangerous thing in America today is an informed housewife with a telephone. I've had to increase that in the last few years. You give that informed housewife who has a telephone, you give her a modem for her telephone and give her a fax, let her onto the Internet and turn loose email, she's downright a menace to society. And from what I can hear, some of you fit right into that category, right? And I'm proud of you. You see, the mainstream media across America today have been what they like to call the guardians of the national consciousness for years. They've been spinning, they've been twisting, they've been massaging, they've been interpreting the news and events, and then they've been spoon-feeding it to us poor dummies out here who simply can't think for ourselves. And according to the writings of this man, Mr. Wright, the possibility of we the people developing our own avenues for getting raw information is simply rattling their liberal cages. I'm for it. The entire tone of the article that I just told you about is one of total alarm. Alarm that the people of America could become so informed and so involved in the policy-making process of America. In fact, he goes on to warn us that this intrusion, can you believe this? That this intrusion of the citizens into the workings of government can simply only get worse. Here's how Mr. Wright puts it in a warning. He says, in cyberspace, technology may have finally reached a point where groups form spontaneously on the Internet, passing information to a neighbor. The next step can be a genuine, unrehearsed protest that rolls into Congress or the White House via email. He comes to this conclusion. He says the challenge is to buffer the legislature from the pressure of feedback. They don't want you involved in their making policy. Because you see, ladies and gentlemen, there is only one source that is supposed to give you information and news, and that's the mainstream media. And of course, they simply want to let the liberal media be the intermediary for all public policy discussions. The thing that really tickled my heart from Mr. Wright was, in the end, he simply had to take a shot at talk radio. Loved it. Here's what he says. He says the explosion of radio call-in shows has created a new form of electronic populism and demagoguery. I loved a demagogue. I'd do it 2 hours a day, 5 days a week, Mr. Wright. Thank you very much. He says, a form of electronic populism and demagoguery, more than 1,000 talk stations, and then he goes on to say, and hundreds more with evangelical Christian commentators delivering hot chat to an avid constituency. I love it. You know, I love to demagogue. In fact, unlike Rush Limbaugh, I take names and give out phone numbers. In fact, the things that we do and others like us are Mr. Wright's worst nightmare. Let me give you an example. Back in February of 1994, there was an amendment added at the last minute to a major education bill pending in Congress. Now, without alternative media, this would never have been known by the American people. It would have passed. We would have had to have lived with it. Nobody would have known about it because the mainstream media would have chosen simply not to tell the American people. Well, this amendment would have effectively required teachers in private Christian schools and homeschooling parents in every state to be certified by the government. Major media outlets were completely uninterested in covering the story, even though more than 1 million American families engaged at that time in homeschooling. Well, Congressman Dick Armey called our office, talked to us, and said, look, we need a little help getting this story out to the public. And so we took the story, ran with it. We broke it on Point of View Radio talk show, alerting the Christian community all across the nation. What happened as a result of that? I'll tell you what I'd like to do. I'd like to let a reporter with the New York Times syndicate tell you all about it. Now, the New York Times, unless you're not aware, is not a member of the vast right-wing conspiracy. So here's what this gentleman said, the New York Times syndicate. He said, Mr. Maddox feels that talk radio has empowered the general public to express their opinions, and by all accounts, it works. One of the biggest successes involving the mobilization of the masses involved Mr. Maddox and a homeschool parent from New Jersey who, along with Representative Dick Armey, Texas Republican, mounted a campaign against a now-failed measure that would have forced homeschool parents to be certified by the state educational system, the very system from which they were running. Says Mr. Maddox, I watched our program and others amplify that parent's call into a political sonic boom felt round the nation and especially Washington. House members' phones and fax lines were jammed. Some offices reported thousands of calls coming in one day, and the liberals retreated, leaving the bill to die a violent death. Mike Ferris, who many of you know, with Homeschool Legal Defense Fund, who I talked to, told me that they reached 200,000 individuals through fax and telephone trees in the space of 72 hours about that issue. And as a result of our combined efforts, the radio, other programs taking it, other organizations getting involved, there was an avalanche of calls and faxes to Washington absolutely opposing the measure. One congressional chief of staff begged a homeschool lobbyist, please stop calling. I believe in democracy. It's just that we've had about as much democracy as we can handle in one day. To give you an example, to tell you how it worked out, the amendment, which was expected to pass overwhelmingly, was defeated by a vote of 424-1. Now, the fact, ladies and gentlemen, that this particular bill went down to defeat is not the real story. The real story of what happened is something that took the national media and the Washington pundits absolutely by surprise and took them by storm. I'm told by more than one source that we produced more telephone calls to Washington in the history of the city. Mike Ferris told me that Newt Gingrich told him that the city of Washington's phone system had been totally shut down. They had received 3 million telephone calls regarding that one issue. Now, you see what people can do when they're informed and involved? In fact, it got national attention. You know, we don't know what's going to happen. We just put it out there. As I say, I give names and I give telephone numbers. The Dallas Morning News did a front page story on the Point of View program as a result of that. CBS Evening News taped an entire program and used bites on the evening news talking about the outpouring from the people across America. NBC sent a crew out there. I'll never forget. NBC's crew is crawling around in the studio. We tell them, bring your cameras, bring your lights, everything. And we just open the studio. The program goes on. They're milling around in the studio, taking their pictures and so on. And after they had filmed the two-hour program, I remember one lady came up to me, talked very quietly, as if not to be overheard by anybody. And she looked around to see that no one was looking. NBC, one of the NBC people, and she said, Mr. Maddox, I'd just like to let you know that I've been listening to you for years, and I appreciate what you're saying, and what you say is the truth. So thank you, NBC, for that. Later, Nightline sent a crew to our studios, taped the program, used some of the bottom line. After all of this publicity, I ask myself why there is such interest in this. I've thought about the media coverage, and I think I came up with the bottom line at that particular time. You see, they don't understand what's going on. How are these people getting their information, they're trying to say? You see, they don't know an evangelical Christian. Some of them stuck up at Washington, D.C. and New York City. In fact, one ABC reporter also told me, said kind of laughingly, said, one of our people up in New York called us and said, look, go out somewhere and find one of these evangelical Christians and then ask them what they think about so-and-so in Dallas. And the lady said, but I doubt if I can find one. They're probably in church. And the woman from New York said, church? Is that a Southern thing? You see, they don't understand. They don't know. Their circle of friends does not include any pro-lifers. It does not include any evangelical Christians. It does not include anybody who are conservatives. They are not politically correct. They don't know them. They don't associate with them. And so they don't even know that they exist. And so I've asked myself, and what they're doing is asking themselves now, how are these people getting informed? How are they getting their information? How can they mobilize a tidal wave of response like 3 million people over one issue, calling, faxing, contacting people in Washington, D.C.? They're asking, who are they listening to? Who's furnishing them with these alternative views? And I think also what they're saying is, why are we losing control of the national consciousness? And some of the biggest networks doing the news, folks, are losing money. They're losing audience by the millions. And it's because there are other avenues where people are getting information. John Fund is editorial writer, was editorial. I'm not sure if he still is. I think he is. Editorial writer for the Wall Street Journal. And John Fund said this. He said, we, the media gatekeepers, had better look out. The gate is swinging wide open. We can no longer effectively bottle up information and keep it from the public if we don't like it. The Berlin Wall that existed for decades in the media industry is falling apart brick by brick. Dr. Robert Lichter said, the congregation has rebelled against the media priesthood and is doing an end run around it. Let me tell you something. Some of you ask, Marlon, why is it that all of the media people seem to sound alike? got the same bias, sing off the same tune, have the same glary, starry, glassy-eyed look in their eyes when they talk about conservative values or Christian values, as if they don't know what we're talking about. Well, you know John Corey. He was former radio and television editor with the New York Times. And as I have pointed out, the New York Times is not exactly the conservative digest, as you know. And John Corey, former radio television editor, in one of his columns, one of his writings, addressed the question, does journalism, particularly television, labor under a liberal bias? I just love it when Sam Donald comes on with his big cow eyes and says, what liberal bias? And people like Tim Russert come on and they say, if it's Sunday morning, it's biased. Some of the others, they simply do not understand it when you try to say that the national major media is biased against conservatives, against Christians, and against values that we hold dear. Why? Why does it say that? Why do they look the camera right in the eye and with a sincere look on their face say, we are not biased? I don't know where you get it. Colkey Roberts says, these people that say we're biased are just out of touch. They don't understand. Well, Mr. Corey, who should know, answering the question, does journalism, particularly television, labor under a liberal bias, he writes, of course it does, but not consciously or deliberately. So the next time you look at one of the talking heads and you see one of them say, I don't understand when they say we're biased, he believes that. Mr. Corey said they do operate from a liberal bias, but not consciously or deliberately. He says the fault is not in the journalists so much as in their dominant culture, which he describes as the product of the opinions and the preferences of the country's artists and intellectuals. Corey says the culture determines the point of view. It focuses the journalist's attention. Most importantly, it applies the moral dimensions to his thinking, allowing him to identify good and just causes. He goes on to say, and that culture is rooted firmly in the political left, where it finds its own closed frame of reference, little dissent is tolerated, and little is found. And then he concludes, the right wing is considered without question the enemy. And so when Hillary Clinton sits in front of the camera and says, all of the problems that we have got, have nothing to do with us, nothing to do with what we've done right or wrong, I should say, it simply has to do with a vast right wing conspiracy of people. And she should have said, who are our enemies. Does she believe it? She believes it. You know, ladies and gentlemen, there comes times in our lives that we go along thinking everything's okay. We got it all together. We understand the problem. We've got it all put together. We've got our worldview. Life is good. And we don't want anything to disturb it. And then all of a sudden something comes along and challenges what we've always held dear. Makes us stop and take a look at things. Makes us begin to question things that we've always held as being absolute and beyond any question whatsoever. And when those times come, I call those defining moments. Some of you may be here at this convention. You may hear a speaker speak. It says something that totally changes your way of thinking, your worldview. You have a paradigm shift in the way you are thinking about certain issues. And it becomes for you a defining moment. I've had several. One of my defining moments came as a result of one of those ladies I told you about who's dangerous. They've got information, they got telephones and so on. I've been doing talk radio in Dallas a few years. didn't get into the issues. I'd hear people talk about a conspiracy of people trying to change America from the way that it's always been, that some kind of a socialistic, secularistic, secular humanistic society. And one of the things that really used to, as they say in the Deep South, fry my grits were these people that would come along and say that there were people somewhere writing textbooks and were rewriting American history and were trying to undermine the founding fathers and everything that we believed in and trying to lead us toward a socialistic government. I would rail against them. Show me evidence, show me proof. People would call me up, say, Mr. Maddox, you're an intelligent man. I appreciate what you're saying and what you're doing. But on this issue, you're absolutely wrong. They're out there. They're working against the best interests of America. And I'd slam the phone in their face and say, show me the evidence. You know, to be a talk show host, you've got to be a little mean. And I was kind of mean to some of these people. And so I heard about a lady that was going down to Austin, Texas, capital of Texas, and she was causing all manner of trouble talking about textbooks. So I decided I'd have her on the program, and we'd get this thing over once and for all, and after I made a fool out of her, then we could get on with life. Well, you know, the time came, and about 5 minutes before airtime, my guest, Mrs. Joanne McCauley, she's passed away now. She hadn't shown up. Now, if you want to get a talk show host extremely nervous, at 5 minutes before airtime, don't be there. That's when the hands start to sweat a little bit, little adrenaline starts pumping, and you look for plan B. In fact, I'll give you a secret. At Point of View Radio Talk Show, we always have plan B in case the phone goes down, the guest doesn't show up, and we're caught flat-footed and we got to talk. And what we've got are some golden stories, some undated type stories that we can go right into and we'll make you sound like it just happened today. And to make sure that everybody knows that this is an emergency, we've got the carts with the sounders and the stories on them, and we've got them numbered, the 911 series. Now, is that a good way or not? That's an emergency. So I got up out of my chair, and I walked to the door and looked out, and Mrs. McCauley still wasn't coming. About 3 minutes to airtime, I walked out to the hall, and I looked down the hall, and coming down the hall was this very attractive lady. And she was stumbling. Now, the reason she was stumbling is because she had loads of books under the left arm, loads of book under the right arm. She had a cloth satchel that was around over this shoulder, and it was full of books. And I kid you not, folks, she had about 3 big books under the chin, and she was doing her best to waddle down the, down the hallway. So I ran out, and I asked her, are you Mrs. McCauley? And when she shook her head, about 5 books dropped down. I picked them up, we rushed in, we sat down, we began to talk, and I began my Mike Wallace inquisition. Well, if you ever watched a fight when one guy's winning for about 3 rounds, and then slowly things begin to change, and the other one's coming on, and I felt myself weakening as I'm doing a battle with Joanne McCauley, and she's so charming, I can't get mad at her. Good-looking lady, I'm sitting there, and she's so kind. And as we're going on, and this bloodletting had been going on for about an hour and a half, and when she saw that she pretty well had me soften up, it was time for the coup d'etat. It was time for the kill. And so behind this smiling face, there lay the eyes of an animal about ready to pounce on its prey. And she took a book in her hand, and she reached over, and she said, Mr. Maddox, I can't say this sweetly, you'd think I was a funny guy, but Mr. Maddox, would you please read this for me over the air? Of course, I make my business reading. You think I'm a dummy? I can read. And so I took the book, and I started reading. Now, if you do public speaking or if you read out loud, one of the things that you always do is you're reading 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 words ahead, right before it comes out of your mouth. Am I correct? You always read ahead. Now, the reason you do that, because if you just read one word at a time like this, you would sound like Al Gore. And you don't want to sound like Al Gore, do you? And so I'm reading along there, and I stop dead in my tracks. My face turns pale, and I look up at Mrs. McCauley, who is smiling broadly. And I say, you got to get on this radio voice now, Mrs. McCauley. I can't read this over the air. Why not, Mr. Maddox? I said, well, Mrs. McCauley, this is before Imus and what this other idiot, Stern, before their days when there's a little respect for the human mind. And I said, well, if I were to read this over the air, not only would I offend all of the audience, I could be fined by the FCC $5,000 and maybe even go to prison, knowing now that she had the mouse firmly in her jaws. She says, very sweetly, isn't it interesting, Mr. Maddox? Ooh, I hated that. I had been set up, and she had given me the knockout punch, and it was embarrassing. I got my pride. She says, isn't it interesting, Mr. Maddox, that you cannot read those words? She did it slowly, like a knife. That you cannot read those words over the air, but yet there are thousands of children in elementary schools all over America who can walk into the library and sit down and read these books and even check them out and take them home. Now we're talking dirty, filthy, rotten words. Now, this is back in, 75. It's gotten so worse since then. But you know what that was? That was a defining moment. I left that studio today. I walked to my car. I was in a daze, absolute daze. And I'm saying to myself, could it possibly be that there is an undermining current in this world, in this nation, that is trying to change us away from what we've always held dear and change us into a society that is corrupt, a society that resembles more a society like Soviet Russia or an atheistic country? The answer, ladies and gentlemen, after months of study, soul-searching, beginning of an odyssey which continues until this day, I came to the firm conclusion that there are people in this country who do not like the institutions and the basis upon which this nation is founded, and they're doing their best to undermine it. Now, for years I've talked to the American people about the dangerous consequences of the psychological tampering and outright brainwashing which I discovered is going on in the public schools by our nation's children, by the intrusive, monopolistic school system, better known as the public school system, which should not be public school system, it should be the government schools. Now, while the public school system has many dedicated teachers in it, and I'm not taking a shot at you, so don't get your dander up. While there's a lot of dedicated Christian teachers in it, the system itself is undermining the moral values of our nation, and I believe, have become a definite hindrance and a bad thing for our country. In the public schools, our children are being taught there's no God. You say, I'm a school teacher and I'm a Christian. I try to get around it. No. the doctrine of the public school, keep God out of the classroom. The other thing that they're taught is that there are no moral absolutes. You can't teach your Christian beliefs. They're also taught that they're the products of evolution, mindless chance. They're also taught that there is no clear meaning to life. Therefore, human beings have no intrinsic worth, no special place on this planet. John Dewey, father of modern education, we might call it, was an atheist. He was a socialist. He signed the Humanist Manifesto. He assigned to the school system a revolutionary mission. That revolutionary mission was the mission of dictating values to children and therefore transforming society into an atheistic, socialistic society. Now, what's been the result of these 30 or 40 or 50 years of this kind of secular indoctrination? What's the result of it? I'm going to give you some answers today that some of you are wrestling with and you don't understand what's going on and why it's going on. I'm going to give you some answers. Please listen very carefully. What's been the result of these years of secular indoctrination? Professor Robert Simon, who teaches philosophy at Hamilton College in Clinton, New York, says that in 20 years of college teaching, that he's never met a student who denied that the Holocaust actually happened. Never met a student who denied that the Holocaust, taking the lives of 6 million Jews and millions of others, actually happened. But he said what he sees quite often, though, is worse. He says that his students acknowledge the fact of the Holocaust, but that they cannot bring themselves to say that killing millions of human beings is wrong. Mr. Simon states that 10 to 20% of his students feel this way. He said usually they deplore what the Nazis did, but their disapproval is expressed as a matter of taste, our personal preference, not moral judgment. Of course, I dislike Nazis, one student told him, but who is to say that they are morally wrong? The shocking fact, ladies and gentlemen, is that such indoctrination is producing and has produced moral illiterates who could be open to all kinds of atrocities against their fellow human beings right here in this country sometime in the not-too-distant future. Now, to illustrate that point, two very disturbing articles came out in what's called the Chronicle of Higher Education. They say that some students are, quote, unwilling to oppose large moral horrors, including human sacrifice, ethnic cleansing, and slavery, because they think it seems obvious that no one has the right to criticize the moral views of another group or culture. Kay Hogard, who teaches at Pasadena College in California, in that article she writes that her current students have a lot of trouble expressing any moral reservations or objections about human sacrifice. The subject, she says, came up when she taught her class on Shirley Jackson's story, The Lottery. It's a short story about small American farm families who kill one person each year to make the crops grow. And in the tale, a woman is ritually stoned to death by her husband and children. In classes she taught since 1970, Miss Hogard says that Jackson's message about blind conformity has always spoke to my students' sense of right and wrong, but no longer apparently. Class discussion of human sacrifice, she says, yielded no moral comments, even under persistent questioning. One male student said the ritual killing almost seems like a need. Asked if she believed in human sacrifice, a woman said, "I don't really know." Miss Hogard writes, "I was stunned. There was a woman who wrote so passionately of saving the whales, of concern for the rainforest, and tender care of a stray dog, but asked if she believed in human sacrifice, said, "I don't really know." Christina Hoff Summers, author, professor of philosophy, Clark University in Massachusetts, said that students who can't bring themselves to condemn the Holocaust will often say flatly that treating humans as superior to dogs and rodents is immoral. But she writes, moral criticism is alive and well on selected issues such as smoking, environmentalism, women's rights, animal rights. But she writes that students coming to college are, quote, dogmatically committed to moral relativism that offers them no grounds to think about cheating, stealing, and other moral issues. It's also affected church-going young people. Josh McDowell conducted surveys among the church-going young people of America. What he found was astounding. Here's what he said. 57% of church-attending youth cannot state that there is an objective standard of truth anymore. It's the Bible, ladies and gentlemen, the objective standard of truth. But 57% of your children and grandchildren attending your churches regularly cannot come out and say that the Bible is the standard of truth. Okay, let's take a look at the result of decades of this kind of national brainwash. What does it mean, Marlon? I think you can begin to understand why in this present political climate of ours today, why the public is incapable of saying that the president's actions in the Oval Office are wrong. If they can't say that killing is wrong, if they can't say that human sacrifice is wrong, how can they say that these things are wrong? They are totally, absolutely incapable of saying these things are wrong. This country, ladies and gentlemen, is going through what I call a dialectic. Look it up in the dictionary. It's where two ideas clash. It's like two warriors that come together. These two ideas come together and they clash, and only one of them is going to survive. It's the old Marxist synthesis, antithesis, and so on. You know, ladies and gentlemen, this country is going through this battle between what's right and what's wrong. It's going through a dialectic. Clashing ideas on morality, freedom, economics, politics, and philosophy. Will we continue on the same course set by the founding fathers, or is it going to be a European-style socialistic Marxist nation? And I predict to you the worst is yet ahead. The Star Report, or some report, finally hits the China connection, the FBI files, the White House enemies list, and so on. Bill Clinton could very well go down in history as one of the most despised presidents America has ever had. And I'm going to tell you why I say that. It's not going to be what you thought. Why do I say that? He could very well go down as one of the most despised presidents in American history because by flaunting his immoral lifestyle in the public's face, he has opened up a national debate on the moral values of the new left. Moral relativism. No right, no wrong. This is what the children have been taught for generations. This is why they can come and say, ethnic cleansing I can't condemn. Human sacrifice I cannot condemn. I cannot even condemn the Holocaust because none of us has the right to pass moral judgment on anybody else. That is the generation that we're seeing today. We saw it on the bus, some people right here, this city, discussing it, talking about Clinton. The lady shrugged her shoulders. Who cares? We can't pass judgment. But you see, moral relativism says there's no right, there's no wrong. And what's happening is that those values are coming up short. They're looking less and less attractive with each new revelation of the president's abhorrent lifestyle. As Chris Matthews said on MSNBC, we thought he would at least control himself for the 8 years he was in office. You see, folks, the baby boomers themselves may possibly come to despise him. In fact, you can see the agony on the faces of the television talking heads as they try to deal with the moral deterioration of our culture. They don't like what they're seeing, but they're incapable of finding fault with what's happening. Watch them. I don't like it. He shouldn't have done it. But you ask them, can you say it's wrong? I can't say that it's wrong. They are incapable of saying that this or anything else is right or is wrong because they've been taught there are no moral absolutes. And they're totally incapable of saying that any behavior of any kind is in fact wrong. Now, I've agonized over the fact that the people of this nation have somehow disconnected from the president's personal morality and are giving him a pass on things that earlier would have brought a national outcry for his removal from office as unfit to serve. Eisenhower, if he had done it, out. If they had known John F. Kennedy had done it, out. But they're incapable. I've agonized. I've asked myself, why is it that they're incapable of any kind of a moral outcry? And the answer is, there has been a very effective, organized, well-defined, well-financed attack on the moral foundations of our culture for many decades, which I've just told you about. And as a result of that assault on the minds and the values of the American people, a majority of Americans have either accepted that there are no moral absolutes, or they have become so confused that they're incapable of arguing their case intellectually. Bill and Hillary Clinton brought their new ideas to Washington and shoved them in the face of the nation. The playing out of their radical politics and new morality has thrown the nation headlong into a moral crisis of major proportions. What's at stake here? Why have these people fought so hard to protect Bill Clinton regardless of the evidence? Then it dawned on me. Came to me as if you'd turn one of these lights on. It dawned on me that this society is not protecting Bill Clinton. This society is defending their faith. And their faith is moral relativism. Nothing is right and nothing is wrong. If they say that Bill Clinton is wrong, then they have to say that my life is also wrong. They are defending the liberal faith. They're defending moral relativism. They're defending the liberal culture itself. Now let me give you something to fight with. Many of you have been so beat down that you hardly want to argue your case. And I'm going to be honest with you. Up until the president's little, I won't call it a speech. I don't know what that turkey was, but It was a little temper tantrum that what I do is my business and you get out of my life and keep furnishing me with Air Force One and all of my salaries and everything else, and what I do is none of your business. Mr. Clinton is a 14-year-old boy in a 52-year-old body, just to give you. Now, some of you have not been able to defend. Some of you have even been a little bit reticent about saying something is right and something is wrong. But let me tell you what's going on, and I hope it puts a little steel in your mind. The liberal apologists are scrambling. They're trying to make all the pieces fit. They're protecting their liberal worldview. And what you have to understand at this very moment, ladies and gentlemen, that it is not the Christian worldview that's on trial. It is secular humanism. It is moral relativism. It is not Christianity. Christianity is solid, and Bill Clinton is helping to crack moral relativism the way they cracked the Berlin Wall. And if that happens in America, it's all worth what we're going through today. The liberal culture itself is in the dark throes of a gut-wrenching crisis born of liberalism's approval of every immorality. And so no matter what Bill Clinton has done, the liberals are incapable of criticizing him. His great sin was in embarrassing them by getting caught and bringing about this national discussion on moral relativism. Well, I've already been told my time is up, but I've got one thing that I've got to give to you. Talking about the 60s morality, the liberals, and so on. In his book, Resurrecting the Third Reich, the author Richard Terrell writes, he says, the swamp of ethical relativism has led to a quicksand in bed for an entire civilization. It was thought to lead to freedom, yet strange as it may seem, the actual evidence is that ethical relativism leads instead to tyranny. The reason for this is that in moral relativism there is no end. There are no limits it can be legitimately appealed to in case of a society out of control. The ideology does not permit it. But people have to live and will continue to value the safety of their persons and possessions. If the internal moral sense of the people is diminished to an adequate extent throughout the society, the logical desire will be force, a tyranny of order born of the soil of fear. And ladies and gentlemen, I predict that Bill Clinton is allowed to get away with what he has gotten away with. You and I will see the rise of a militaristic force that will try to force morality on us. This, and I'm closing. What's freedom worth to you? What are you willing to give for it? Let me read you something that I've kept filed away for a lot of years. I get it out, read it on occasion. Reminds me of the sacrifice brought about our freedom. Here's what it says. War is an ugly thing, but not the ugliest of all things. The decayed, degraded state of moral and patriotic feelings. To think that nothing is worth war is worse. A man who has nothing for which he is willing to fight, nothing he cares about more than his own personal safety, is a miserable creature who has no chance of being free unless made free and kept free by the exertions of better men than himself. Who wrote that statement about freedom? Well, this inscription was found on a wall of a prison in North Vietnam called the Hanoi Hilton. The author, who obviously believed in what he wrote, was tortured to death. How much is freedom worth to you? Thank you.
If you'd like information about purchasing this presentation on videotape or for a tape catalog of all of the Stealing the Mind of America audio or video tapes, or for future conference information, call Compass at 1-800-977-2177. Or you can write to Compass at 460 Canfield Avenue, Suite 1000, Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, 83815.